Chapter 38, verse 1. About that time, Judah left his brothers and camped near a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. Judah, who came up with the idea to sell Joseph into slavery, may have considered himself particularly responsible for Joseph's disappearance and the subsequent unending grief of his father. The other brothers possibly even came to blame him for suggesting that they sell Joseph into slavery. Chapter 37, verse 27. This could explain his decision to distance himself from his brothers. Verse 2. There Judah saw the daughter of a certain Canaanite, whose name was Shua, and he married her and cohabited with her. Judah married a Canaanite woman, which was prohibited by Abraham, Genesis chapter 24, verse 3, and by later Torah law, Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 3. This is another argument for the antiquity of the Torah, given the Torah's ban on marrying and disdain for the Canaanites. As Sarna correctly notes, later tradition would hardly have invented the uncomfortable account about his, Judah's, marriage to one. Verse 3. She conceived and bore a son, and he named him Ur. Verse 4. She conceived again and bore a son, and named him Onan. Verse 5. Once again she bore a son, and named him Shelah. And he was at Kezib when she bore him. Verse 6. Judah got a wife for Ur, his firstborn. Her name was Tamar. Verse 7. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was displeasing to the Lord, and the Lord took his life. The Torah does not specify Ur's offense, which the Torah characterizes as ra, Hebrew for bad or evil, not displeasing. This is not common in the Torah. When God took a person's life, the reason was almost always given, but it must have been a grave offense. Ur is the first named individual in the Bible whose life God takes as punishment. It should be noted that the two consonants of his name spelled backwards spell out the word ra, evil, suggesting he was bad from the get-go. Brother-in-law, levirate, marriage. Verse 8. Then Judah said to Onan, "Join with your brother's wife and do your duty by her as a brother-in-law, and provide offspring for your brother." The duty Judah invoked refers to an ancient law known as levirate marriage, known in Hebrew as yibam. Levir is the Latin word for brother-in-law. This law obligated a man whose brother had died childless to marry and impregnate his brother's widow. The resulting child was customarily given the dead brother's name and considered to be a successor to the dead brother's line. At that time, the surviving brother had no choice in the matter, nor was the widow free to decline marriage to her dead husband's brother. The Torah later modified this tradition by allowing a brother to refuse to marry his brother's widow, though he would then have to partake in a public ceremony, halitza, in which the late brother's widow removed the man's sandal and spat at him because he refused to preserve his brother's name in Israel. See Deuteronomy chapter 25, verses 5 through 10. As this incident predates the Torah, halitza may not have been an option, leaving a brother with no choice but to marry his late brother's widow. As primitive as it might sound to us today, levirate marriage was a way to help a widow have both children and economic security. Verse 9. But Onan, knowing that the seed would not count as his, the child would be legally viewed as that of his late brother, Ur. What was Onan's sin? Verse 9 continued, "Let it go to waste whenever he joined with his brother's wife, so as not to provide offspring for his brother." Onan's sin was making sure not to impregnate Tamar whenever he slept with her. In so doing, he cheated Tamar by preventing her from having children. He cheated his father and father-in-law by pretending to fulfill the obligation of levirate marriage. And he cheated his late brother by denying him an heir and the preservation of his name in Israel. Onan was presumably motivated by greed. He did not want to produce a child who would be credited to his brother, because that would constitute a third heir upon the death of his father Judah. At that point, Judah had two heirs, Onan and Shua. But if had an heir, a third party would share in the inheritance of Judah's estate. The Talmud suggests Onan sinned by refusing to complete intercourse with Tamar, so that she not become pregnant and thereby spoil her beauty. There is no evidence for this explanation in the text, but the explanation reflects how important Judaism deemed having children and its opposition to using a woman merely for sexual pleasure. Genesis contains story after story of brothers who mistreat brothers, in this case, even a dead brother. While the reasons may have differed, a birthright blessing, envy, parental favoritism, and now money, the resentments were all deep. Genesis also contains story after story depicting deception. Deception of Tamar and Judah is only the most immediate example. If this book of the Bible were not named Genesis, it might well be named Deceptions. Abraham deceived Pharaoh. Abraham deceived Abimelech. Jacob and Rebekah deceived Isaac. Laban and Leah deceived Jacob. Rachel deceived Laban. Simeon and Levi deceived the Shechemites. Joseph's brothers deceived Jacob. Onan deceived Tamar and Judah. Judah deceived Tamar. Tamar deceived Judah. Potiphar's wife deceived Potiphar. Joseph deceived his brothers. Verse 10. What he did was displeasing to the Lord, and he took his life also. Many traditional Jewish and Christian teachings have interpreted Onan's sin as masturbation, which is the origin of the term Onanism. However, this is a misreading of the Torah, which explicitly states Onan's sin was not the wasting of his seed per se. It was his refusal to complete sexual relations with Tamar, provide her offspring, and thereby perpetuate his dead brother's name. Essay: Religion and Sexual Sin. The interpretation of this biblical verse, that Onan's sin was masturbation, reflects a difference between the Torah's views on sexual matters and many later Jewish and Christian views. The Torah treats sex more as a natural part of life than as a particularly sinful part of life. Of course, sex, like any powerful human urge, can lead to terrible sin and evil. King David having Uriah killed so that he could get away with having slept with and impregnated Uriah's wife is one such example. Others would be the sexualization of religion and the sexualization of the family. But sex is not the particularly sinful area of life with which it later became identified. To cite the Onan story as an example, the Torah never mentions, let alone prohibits, masturbation. Yet in ancient, medieval, and even more modern times, Jews and Christians were often taught it was a particularly terrible sin, even equating it with murder. The result of religious people equating masturbation and marital coitus interruptus with great sin has been a loss of moral credibility to religion, and the subsequent alienation of many people from religion. Religiosity so often came to be equated with sexual sin that for most people to this day, the word immoral primarily connotes sexual sin. This happened in part because many religious people dropped the distinction between unholy and immoral. While acknowledging sexual activity outside of marriage is not holy, not all such activities should be labeled immoral. For example, two widowed seniors living together without marrying out of financial necessity, marrying in such circumstances often result in the loss of pension income or health insurance, is not religiously permitted, but it would not serve either the cause of religion or morality to declare them immoral. The Torah makes clear Tamar's subsequent sexual sin, starting with verse 13, was forgiven because of a higher good, conceiving a child unfairly denied to her by her husband's family. God choosing a prostitute, Rahab, see Joshua chapter 2, to save the Israelites when they entered Canaan should have sent humanity a message, and so should this chapter of the Torah. Tamar acts as a prostitute, deceives her father-in-law into sleeping with her, and conceives his child, and she is in no way condemned for doing so. Indeed, she is a heroine in the story. Of course, marriage is the one holy place for sexual relations, and it is to the Torah's everlasting credit that it eroticized marriage and made the marital bed the place for sex. These concepts are explained at length in my commentary on Leviticus. But religion loses credibility when it is primarily associated with sexual sin. The labeling of Onan's sin masturbation when it wasn't, the sin was refusing to enable his brother's widow to conceive a child, is one such example. Verse 11. Then Judah said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, "Stay as a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up," for he thought he too might die like his brothers. So Tamar went to live in her father's house. This is a rare instance of the Torah telling us what someone is thinking. Apparently, under the Levirate marriage law, there was no mechanism for releasing a widow to marry outside her husband's family, specifically her brother-in-law, if her deceased husband had a living brother. Shelah, who at this point was still a minor, was next in line to provide his dead brother's widow with a child once he was old enough to marry. But given what had already happened to his two sons who had married her, Judah felt she brought bad luck, so he sent her home to her father. Verse 12. A long time afterward, Shua's daughter, the wife of Judah, died. The Torah mentions the death of Judah's wife to let the reader know Judah's subsequent behavior takes place only once he is again an unmarried man. That is relevant in morally assessing Judah sleeping with Tamar. This verse also notes that this was a long time afterward, long enough for Shelah to have reached a marriageable age. Verse 12 continued. When his period of mourning was over, Judah went up to Timnah to his sheep shearers, together with his friend Hira the Adullamite. Verse 13. And Tamar was told, "Your father-in-law is coming up to Timnah for the sheep shearing." Tamar acts like a prostitute, and God does not condemn her for it. Verse 14. So she took off her widow's garb, covered her face with a veil, and wrapping herself up, sat down at the entrance to Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah was grown up, yet she had not been given to him as wife. Tamar realized her father-in-law was not going to see to it that his last remaining son marry her. Consequently, she would not only be cheated out of having children, but also out of the economic security of marriage. So, having waited for many years to marry Shelah and aching for a child, she decided to take matters into her own hands. Once again, we find a woman in the Bible taking the initiative in a patriarchal world. See Rebecca's behavior in Genesis chapter 27, when she sees her husband is about to make a major blunder, and Naomi's and Ruth's behavior in the book of Ruth, chapter 3. And most important, the Torah does not condemn Tamar for acting like a prostitute, seducing her father-in-law, and sleeping with him. Indeed, Tamar is regarded as a particularly righteous woman, worthy of being the ancestor of King David. Ruth chapter 4, verse 17. See commentary to verse 39 in this chapter, and ultimately, of the Messiah. The Torah, of course, regards prostitution as a sin, but as noted above, This is another example of the Torah not deeming all sexual sin as quite as terrible as many religious people came to view it throughout history. The Torah views Tamar's sexual sin as less serious than Judah's deceiving her into believing she will be able to make a family through Judah's third son, Shelah. Verse 15. When Judah saw her, he took her for a harlot, for she had covered her face. It was Tamar's good fortune that prostitutes apparently covered their faces at that time and in that place. Otherwise, Judah would have recognized her. Verse 16. So he turned aside to her by the road and said, "Here, let me sleep with you," for he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. "What," she asked, "will you pay for sleeping with me?" Verse 17. He replied, "I will send a kid from my flock." But she said, "You must leave a pledge until you have sent it." Verse 18. And he said, "What pledge shall I give you?" She replied, "Your seal and cord and the staff which you carry." Tamar was very clever in making this request. It saved her life. The seal was a small stone with writing cut into it that could make an impression in a wax or tallow seal on a document and serve as a form of identification. The cord was a custom-made article of clothing, and the staff was carved, therefore probably unique. Alter notes the contemporary equivalent would be asking for a person's driver's license and credit cards. Verse 18 continued, "So he gave them to her and slept with her, and she conceived by him." Verse 19, "Then she went on her way. She took off her veil and again put on her widow's garb." Verse 20, "Judah sent the kid by his friend the Adullamite to redeem the pledge from the woman, but he could not find her." Hira the Adullamite was the very definition of a good friend, a person to whom you can tell anything, even something humiliating, and who will stay loyal to you. Verse 21, "He inquired of the people of that town, 'Where is the cult prostitute, the one at Enaim, by the road?' But they said, 'There has been no prostitute here.'" In this verse, Judah's friend referred to Tamar as a cult prostitute, Kedesha, but in verse 15, she was described as an ordinary harlot, Zana. Perhaps the friend was trying to protect Judah's honor. Going to a pagan cult prostitute was probably less humiliating than going to an ordinary one. It was, after all, a religious act. Or perhaps Judah's friend, being a polytheist, simply assumed the woman was a cult prostitute. Verse 22. "So he returned to Judah and said, 'I could not find her. Moreover, the townspeople said, there has been no prostitute here.'" Verse 23. "Judah said, 'Let her keep them, lest we become a laughingstock.'" Judah spoke in the plural, as if what he did reflected on his friend Hira as well as on himself. Verse 23 continued, "I did send her this kid, but you did not find her." Judah made an honorable attempt to find Tamar. He also had an interest in having his belongings returned to him. Verse 24. "About 3 months later, Judah was told, 'Your daughter-in-law Tamar has played the harlot. In fact, she is with child by harlotry. Bring her out,' said Judah, 'and let her be burned.'" From Judah's perspective, Tamar committed adultery because she slept with another man while she was betrothed to Judah's third son, Shelah. Infidelity committed when one was betrothed was considered as serious as when one was married. It was also a stain on Judah's family honor. But Judah's rush to judgment and demand for a particularly cruel punishment, burning was never a Hebrew punishment for adultery, reflected poorly on his character, particularly since it was he who was withholding from her the one man to whom she was permitted. Verse 25. "As she was being brought out, she sent this message to her father-in-law, 'I am with child by the man to whom these belong.' And she added, examine these. Whose seal and cord and staff are these? To her credit, Tamar did not publicly accuse Judah. She conducted herself extraordinarily honorably. Verse 26. Judah recognized them and said, "She is more in the right than I, inasmuch as I did not give her to my son, Shelah." Judah immediately realized what had happened and immediately admitted he was at fault for preventing Shelah from marrying Tamar. Despite engaging in a dishonorable sexual act, the Torah depicts Judah as quite honorable. Throughout history, otherwise honorable men have visited prostitutes. And remember, Judah was unmarried. This is not a defense of the act, but the Torah is subtly telling us not to be too quick to judge in this regard. Verse 26 continued, "And he was not intimate with her again." Verse 27, "When the time came for her to give birth, there were twins in her womb." Verse 28, "While she was in labor, one of them put out his hand, and the midwife tied a crimson thread on that hand to signify, this one came out first." This story is an obvious echo of the birth of Esau and Jacob. Also, by having twins, both Ur and Onan now had sons to replace them, which was the purpose of Yibam. Verse 29, "But just then he drew back his hand, and out came his brother. And she said, what a breach you have made for yourself. So he was named Perez." Perez is Hebrew for breach. According to the genealogy recorded in the fourth chapter of the book of Ruth, Perez, the phonetic spelling, later became the ancestor of David, Ruth chapter 4, verse 17, and therefore the ancestor of the Messiah. The Messiah thus stems from a strange and non-indigenous line. He will be the descendant of both the Canaanite woman Tamar and the Moabite woman Ruth, two nations that were historic enemies of Israel. This is one of the great moral lessons of the Torah. Values matter more than bloodlines. Verse 30, "Afterward, his brother came out, on whose hand was the crimson thread. He was named Zerah."